Succession number 19091, Reel 3.
Bell passes Reel 3.
We got alongside of the Corvette and it was very difficult because the swell. But I've got the women aboard and I pulled the plug on the lifeboat, and that was the last bit of the Pacific Grove that went to the bottom of the ocean, I should imagine. When we got aboard the Corvette, it was absolutely full of survivors. I went into the forecastle and it was awful. The atmosphere with all these people down there. And so I went up on deck and I found a little space at the back of their funnel, which was warm with the heat of the funnel. And I spent the next 4 or 5 days there till we got home. But there was one thing with the Corvette before we actually got away. When we got away, we found that there was a ship laying deep in the water, surrounded by tea chests. I think it was a ship of the British India Navigation Company. The crew had abandoned it, had gone. It was well down in the water. So the Azalea, I mean, these men were very, very brave. Put a boat out. They rowed across to the Azalea, to the ship, and put charges into blow up from the magazine, because it was a danger to shipping. It was just laying there. On their way back, the boat overturned and we went to them and dragged them with nets, and they got aboard the ship. There was about 6 of them, but they'd lost all the booty that they'd collected from the ship, so they must have been disappointed. There also was a submarine warning at the time, and this is why that I think the captain thought we'd better get out of it, and we got out of it quite quickly.
When you were rescued from the sea after the ship had sunk, the Pacific Grove had sunk, how did you get inboard?
Well, as far as I can remember, I mean, I had a thick life jacket on, and I was fit and young, and I got on the boat. I lifted myself up. I suppose the force of the water lifts you up a bit, and I had some help, if I can remember. It's faint now. It's 50 years ago, and it's faint in as much as somebody helped me, you know. There were 2 men there, but they were injured. I don't know what happened to them. But I got aboard. But
what state were the women in the boat?
Well, there was 1 or 2... had hysterics, and that was most uncomfortable because their husbands were aboard in the airport. There was one couple of them who had their husbands aboard, and they were quite, one were hysterical, and I suppose the shock of it all and the unexpectedness of it all. But they were reasonably quiet. They mainly sat there and wrapped canvas round us to try and keep it warm, because April was very cold in the Atlantic, and I think we were heading up towards Greenland by then.
So, what were the hysterical ones doing?
Well, they were just sitting there, but they crying, I suppose you would say. They would be crying with the shock of it. But after a while, they quietened down, and I suppose they thought they'd make the best of it.
Were there any provisions in the lifeboat?
Yes, I wouldn't touch them. I didn't touch anything because I didn't know whether I was going to be there a month, a fortnight. You just don't know. It's an eerie feeling, because everything, you can't see a thing because you keep going down with the troughs of the waves, and you don't know how long you're going to be. So I thought, well, the best thing is to wait till we really need anything before we start to. But when I sunk the boat, we sunk the provisions. We never gave it a thought, really. Never thought about them.
Were you talking to each other in the lifeboat?
Not very much. In fact, I can't really remember a conversation at all with any of them.
What ages were these women?
I should think then they were 25 and 30, were very old.
So you got back to England, you were saying?
Well, on that particular one, that we, I think we got to Scotland, Leith, somewhere like that. And, of course, I only had a seaman's jersey, and which we call jeans now, but they were dungarees in them days. And I had to make our way from Scotland down to London, dressed like that, and people looked at us as though we were something from Mars, because we were salt encrusted, hadn't had a shave for a long time, you know, didn't look all that great. But got home and didn't have much money. They didn't give us much money. They didn't. To be quite frank, they didn't bother too much about us, you know, they were. But we got home, and that was that one. And I think I had a couple of weeks ashore then, I don't know.
Well, you joined the Rangitata in July 1943 at Liverpool.
Yes, but yes, that's right. We were trooping. We were taking troops to Gibraltar, and we used to lay in Gibraltar, you know. The Navy divers used to have to come round the ship twice a day, morning and evening, and go all over the ship, all over the hull, for limpet mines. They were coming off the mainland, these fifth columnists, Germans, whatever you call them, what you like, and they had put some of these limpet mines on ships, and it was a source of danger there, actually. But I don't, as I say, it was reasonably uneventful. We used to see the German aircraft, reconnaissance planes that used to be on the horizon with these convoys, these troop convoys, but we were never attacked. I think the Rangitata, she's one of the few ships that survived the war that I was on.
Whilst you were ashore in between ships, did you ever see or experience anything of the enemy bombing?
Well, when I was in London, of course, it was. We had the air raids, and I was often glad to get back to sea, because you felt so vulnerable. You'd go down the shelter, and my house had a landmine on, in Plasto. Well, not that, the street had a landmine, and the house was more or less finished, and fortunately my parents were evacuated to High Wycombe, and I wasn't at home. And when I did go home the next morning, very little remained of the house.
What was the address of the house?
The house was 93 Sutton Court Road, Plasto. The house has been rebuilt and it's still there now. I went and had a look a couple of years ago, and went there. As I say, I'd lived there all my life mainly.
And when was it destroyed?
It was destroyed during an air raid. The exact date I wouldn't know.
Do you know which year it was?
It would probably be about 43, I believe. It was 43, later end of 43.
How did you like doing trooping work?
I didn't mind the trooping because you had a lot of people to talk to. The troops used to sit up on deck in the evening, and I got to know quite a few of them, and they used to have a drink, and Yeah, I used to, and I used to, I have actually, I had one rather funny experience with them. I went into their mess deck. I was invited one night because these soldiers had had some pineapple. And this was an unusual to get pineapple on the ship or anything like that. And they said, come down and have it. And I was sitting with them, and the officer, he was an officer of the Black Watch, and he came round and he wanted to know if there was any, and I had a jacket on. I had one of the soldiers' jackets on. And of course he thought I was a soldier, and I was sitting there, and he comes up, and because he was supposed to stand up and salute and all this, but I mean, I wasn't familiar at all with the army. And there was a bit of a hullabaloo about it, because I shouldn't have been there, apparently. And when he said to me, everything all right, thinking that I was in charge of the table, because he was a corporal's jacket I had on, I said, yeah, like, that's all right. But of course you don't answer officers like that, apparently, in the army. And it was quite a hullabaloo about it, you know, but they couldn't do nothing to me, but the actual, I believe the corporal got a telling off for having me down there.
How did the soldiers and the crew get on with each other?
Oh, all right, really. I mean, there was nothing. Because we had prisoners of war, too. We used to bring prisoners of war back. We had what they called the calaboose, and that was right by our quarters. There was a German general at one time we brought back. And previous to when I joined the ship, a soldier had challenged a prisoner. I mean, they're prisoners of war. They used to bring the prisoners of war back, and they used to take the troops out and bring these prisoners of war back. And he's fired his gun. It was dark. Prisoners come up to go to the toilet or something, and the bullet mark was still on the ship. And we, but he never killed anybody. But this sentry certainly, he'd opened fire on this German, but fortunately he missed him. But it was quite, didn't mind them ships, really.
Any other memories of Rangitata?
Not particularly. We used to keep a lookout in the funnel. We had two funnels, and one funnel was a dummy funnel, which was quite big. And we used to keep a lookout up there, and so you used to look down on the decks and you used to see all what was going on, and you had lots of wrens and people on board, so it made it different from the normal sort of cargo boat anyway.
And then?
And then the next ship was?
Cornwall again?
The Cornwall, yes. I think that was just before the D-Day, the time we got back.
You joined it 1st of April 1944.
Yes, that's right. June. We got back and we had to lay up in Scotland waiting for something or the other. I think I was with my friend George Thurgar on that particular ship, yes. But no great memories. I know we laid up in Oban for quite a long while.
But I think you have got memories of the next ship, which is the SAMSIP. Is that SS or MV?
SAMSIP, well, it was a Liberty boat, which would be a motor vessel. The Americans built these Liberty boats, as you know, and they supplied a great gap in our merchant fleet because of our losses were so heavy. And that was the best ship I'd ever been on. It was only two to a room. We had a shower. It was typical sort of American design, as against our old tramps that we had. The only trouble was the quarters were very close to the waterline, so there was a great danger there if you got torpedoed. You had it. Now the SAMSIP, we had done one or two trips to Arromanches, which I believe is where they had these pontoons, which were well known at the time. and we used to take tanks and guns and things there. And then we made a trip to Antwerp. We were loaded with tanks, motor vehicles, and we discharged that lot in Antwerp. And we came back down the River Scheldt. And I was on watch on the Monkey Island, which is just above the bridge. For some reason, the captain, Captain Quick, who I got to know quite well after in the docks, he seemed to want us up there. We were very exposed. Very cold night, 7th of December. I had a thick lumber jacket on that I had bought somewhere in Canada, and my life jacket, fortunately. And I was on lookout, looking round. We were in convoy, not many ships, small convoy. And suddenly there was this tremendous explosion. And I woke up, more or less. I was laying at the bottom of the funnel. Laying at the bottom of the funnel, in great pain, with a couldn't breathe, terrible smell of cordite in the air. And there was flames, all the whole ship was ablaze. And so I started to crawl down, and I got down to the foredeck, and there was a few people on the foredeck. We didn't really know what to do. We couldn't see nothing. It was just the flame, the ship was ablaze. So the only thing to do was to get off the ship. And I did, and the only way to get off the ship was to roll over the side. But what I didn't know then was I had a broken back in two places with a fracture. Lacerated hands, the hands were open to the bone. And my left arm, it hadn't broken, but it had become dislocated. It was very painful. Even to this day, it's not straight, it won't straighten, it's still crooked. And I hit the water and went down and down, and then I shot up. Another cold experience. Hung on to a little raft, there were two or three of us, and we drifted away from the ship. No idea how long I was in the water. Couldn't have been long, because I wouldn't have survived. And fortunately, I felt very, very tired. I remember feeling tired, and then hearing the throb of a motor torpedo boat that came alongside, or as close as it could get, and somebody off the ship, the boat, came and got me up. Don't remember nothing. I was laid in a wardroom and put in a long jacket, which is a special name for it. I forget the name they call it. It's like a straight jacket. Took all my clothes off, took my nice lumber jacket. I never saw that again. And I was smothered in fuel oil, my hair and face and hands. And then I was transferred to a minesweeper, Belgian minesweeper. Had I waited on the ship, I'd have been better off, because they came aboard and they rescued a number of the crew. You know, it was very brave, actually, what they'd done, but they got some off. Our captain was rescued, and another chap that I was friendly with, he was rescued. And the next morning I arrived in Ostend, and I remember the tide was out, and I was looking up, facing looking down, and they pulled me up and took me to the British General Hospital. I think it was called the 105. And I laid there for a week. They said that they couldn't move me because of the fear of having paralysis with the nerves and the spine. A Belgian orderly sat alongside of me, and the man was marvellous, because he worked to get this oil off, and fuel oil is very difficult when it's been in salt water to get off the skin. But he persisted in my hair and face, and I lay perfectly still for, it seemed like weeks, but for days, and then they put me in a plaster case, which almost came down to my knees and under my shoulders. That made my shoulders almost level with my ears, which which made the arms very short, which caused a number of problems. But I was there for quite a while, and then round about February I was sent home in a hospital ship. That was full of Germans, mainly. They were officers. They didn't know what to do with me, being a merchant seaman. They, not armed forces, they put me amongst these officers. Many of them had no arms and legs. And they were coming over to the UK. But the hospital ship arrived in Tilbury, and they put me in a, really they were like cattle trucks they put you into, and they took me away. And I ended up in the Middlesex Hospital in Pinner. Pinner, I think, is Mount Vernon, Pinner. And I was there for some time, and the difficult part was learning to walk. And also, if I was laying down, I was trying to get up. My whole body was stiff and rigid, and it was very difficult. But I did master a lot of it, you know, I became a bit better at it. One amusing incident was that they gave me a blue suit with a white shirt and red tie, which they gave to hospital people. And I thought I'd go for a walk. And it was February, and it was bitter cold, very, very cold winter, and snow on the ground. And I went into Pinner, which wasn't very far away. And I had two sticks. On the way back, a little car pulled up. It was one of these Austin Rubies, which were very small, even for them days. And the matron got out, and she said to me, as matrons did them days, "What are you doing out without an overcoat?" And I tried to explain that I didn't have an overcoat because I wasn't armed forces, so they never gave me an overcoat. So she said, "Get in the car." I said, "But if I get in the car, I'll never get out because I've got no movement." "That's all right," she said, "get in." And I got in the back, I fell in the back of the car, and when we got to hospital, and she said, "Get out," I couldn't get out, there's no way. And they ended up taking the front seat, removing the front seat, and sliding me out, the orderlies. And they never, ever picked me up again when they saw me. And that was a little light-hearted thing, really, I suppose. I was sent home after a couple of months because hospital space was, I mean, the war was on, we had casualties, and hospital space was short. They sent me home, and it was at the time of the V2s, and I was in London, and V2s used to fall, and I thought I was more frightened of them than I was of the torpedoes. And I used to mainly prop myself up in a corner, because if I laid down, I couldn't get up. And it was, if I get on a bus, and the bus jerked, I more or less fell forward because there was no way, and people used to touch me, and I would like so hard that they they were amazed. But I survived that. And
did it cause you a lot of pain?
It was painful, but not terribly. The worst part was when I went back to the hospital some months later. I should think it was a long while later. To have the thing cut off. And when they cut it off, they cut up the side, and all the knitting needles fell out, because in the summer it was so hot that I used to sweat and itch. And of course I shed my skin, I was like a snake, really. I mean, I was so thin. I never ate very much, because if you ate anything, your stomach would press against the plaster, and it was most uncomfortable. And of course, I had been used to having this as a support, and when they took that away, it took a lot of physiotherapy to become right again. And one thing about all this, you know, they gave me a pension of £2.50 a week. That's for man and wife. After 2 years, they cut it down to £1.25. A year after that, they gave me £40 and said, thank you very much. And that was it. And I've never received anything after that.
Who paid the pension?
Well, the Ministry of Pensions then at the time was the... Yeah. Another thing which is stated in a little bit of that paper there, the New Zealand Shipping Company sent £5 to the members of the Motor Torpedo Squadron for rescuing some 30 people off the Sam ship. But I suppose that's what we were worth, that lot. But it was after that I didn't do anything for a long, long time. And then I went to work in the docks in London.
How do you feel now about having served in the merchant service in the Second World War?
Oh, I think it was something that I'd done, and I wouldn't really like to have missed it. I often feel that I was very, very fortunate to survive, because out of the 14 ships, only four of them actually survived to after the war. There's one thing I had missed out, which I found I wasn't too keen on. I joined a Belgium coaster somewhere during between ships with a friend of mine, as we wanted to stay round England. I was courting at the time, and I thought, well, this would be an ideal time to run back to London every few weeks. And they were looking for people, or looking for two sailors for the Girondi, was the name of the ship.
How do you spell that?
Girondi. And it was made up mainly of some seamen, some farmers that had escaped from the occupied countries. And none could talk English. And my friend fell ill after 3 days, so I was left alone on this coaster for some 5 or 6 months. I'd signed on in French articles, so I never knew what I signed for. It's not on there because it was a French ship, it was a foreign ship. And we went round the North Sea, up to Glasgow with cement, and it was some very, very rough weather. It was an old ship. I used to have to steer the ship, and the wheel was taller than me, enormous big wheel with chain steering. The captain had some violent dance, so it was rather, you know, I used to have to watch him moving about all the time, and it was very uncomfortable, really. And we all lived in a forecastle, and it had a fire in the corner, a bogey, as they called it, which was a coal fire. And of course, it had a chimney going up onto the forecastle head, and if you hadn't turned it round and the wind was blowing, all the smoke used to come back into the room. And you'd wake up and you were choked. And they seemed to always have red cabbage. I don't know why, but everywhere you looked, there'd be red cabbage on the top of this fire. And I came off the wheel one day. I was at the 8 o'clock in the morning. I've been on the 6 to 8 watch. And I went in the galley for my breakfast. And they gave me a fire.